This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest this week is Barbara Miner, an old friend and journalist in Wisconsin who's written for The Progressive before. She's the author of a crucially important new book called Lessons from the Heartland, a turbulent half-century of public education in an iconic American city, and that city is Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Barbara Miner, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you, Matt.
Seems to me like this book must have been gestating in you for decades.
That is probably an understatement. You know, it's interesting because when I started working on the book, it's interesting. I've been a journalist for 30 plus years. I love to read newspapers, magazines, but when it comes to books, I'm more of a fiction person. And I'm writing this book, and I'm going like, oh my gosh! And at first, it was like, well, it's just like writing 10 magazine articles. You just string them together. And about halfway through, I realized, oh my gosh, what have I got myself into? Because it's not. It's a whole different process. It's in a narrative, and it's history. And one of the interesting things, because I've been writing about education for 20 plus years, and that was crucial to really having the background to even begin to research. But as I'm doing other research for the book, I realized this isn't just history. This is my life. Mm-hmm. Because I grew up in Milwaukee. I left. I grew up, left, and came back. And I'm going over some of this history. And my family, you know, my mother, you know, aunts, uncles, brothers, sisters. You know, my uncle is in the middle of this history. Both of my uncles, my cousins, my brother. So I just was like, how am I going to combine this beast of Milwaukee's history, and it's bringing up all these personal things as well.
It's interesting. You do mention one uncle who did card tricks and seemed like a very amiable uncle, turned out to be kind of a racist running against the mayor of Milwaukee.
And you know, that was fascinating because when I was growing up, my mother had this dictum, no politics or religion at the family gatherings. And yeah, I kind of, okay, fine. You know, my father was Mormon. My mother was Catholic. It seemed to make a little sense. And then now I come to realize why these sort of no politics at Thanksgiving, because, and it's interesting because I look back at that and it really reminded me of how good people, great people can adopt bad policies. And because my Uncle Mac, he was my favorite uncle. He was a great guy. And I never once heard him say anything that could be deemed racist. And then I'm going back and looking at the news clips from 1956. He ran against Frank Zeidler, who was a socialist. And he was a Democrat, but it's a nonpartisan race. And he ran on what was a shameful racist campaign, so shameful that Time magazine in 1956, and you know, Time magazine is not a bastion of progressivism. In 1956, Time magazine said, you know, Milwaukee, the shame of the nation. And it was about the race where my uncle ran for mayor. So anyhow,
How can good people, great people hold such hideous
such
sentiments?
Bad politics.
Yeah.
I mean,
how do you wrestle with that?
It was difficult for me to wrestle with it. And one of the things that's difficult about policy is too often I think people really do policy by vignette. Oh, he's a good person, you know, give him the benefit of the doubt. He really, this is an okay policy. And that happens a lot with vouchers in public education. And, you know, I rail as a journalist. You know, I think stories are absolutely essential. You can't have policies that forget people are people. But I also rail against policy by vignette because that's what Ronald Reagan did. You know, he told the story of the welfare queen and changed the political discussion in this country. That story about the welfare queen was completely false. It was racial code. And you know, a lot of people think Reagan was a nice guy. Well, yeah, but he was, I mean, well, we don't need to get into, for your audience, Ronald Reagan's politics.
Give us a sense, Barbara Miner, of the arc of Milwaukee, especially starting with the Great Migration, which started a little late in Milwaukee compared to other cities like Detroit and Chicago. But Milwaukee in, I want to tell me what date, 1945, 1950, was only about 3 or 4 or 5% black, right? And then it got increasingly.
In Milwaukee, the Great Migration is, you know, pretty much, and it's one of the seminal stories of the 20th century when the blacks moved from the South to the jobs in the North. And in other cities, as you say, like Chicago, Detroit, you know, the 30s, the 40s, Milwaukee's migration was really sort of a second-generation migration. So it really, it started after World War II, but it continued way into the 1960s because there were still jobs in Milwaukee. I mean, there were good family-supporting, family-sustaining jobs in Milwaukee. And the black middle class was just beginning to become established, just beginning when deindustrialization hit like a Mack truck.
So this is a huge part of the story, Lessons from the Heartland, about Milwaukee and also about the education system in Milwaukee. Deindustrialization started in the 70s. The black population in Milwaukee had risen to about 30%, 35%. There was one generation then of black middle class. And then how did deindustrialization occur in Milwaukee, and what were the impacts?
Well, it basically tore the heart out of the city. I mean, interestingly, there's one date that, to me, really tells a story, and that's January 17th, about as cold as it is right now today, 1983. And A. O. Smith, at that point, one of the big manufacturers in Milwaukee, was holding a job fair. They knew there were going to be a fair number of people applying, so they decided to hold it at State Fair. People started lining up the night before, hundreds of people. You know, they had sleeping bags and blankets. They even had, you know, they started fires in trash cans. It kind of was reminiscent of scenes from the Depression, of just hundreds of people huddled around trash cans to keep warm. So anyway, by the time the fair opened, I think it was 8 or 9 in the morning, there were 15,000 people who lined up looking for jobs. There were 150 to 200 openings. And that, more than any single, and the pictures in the paper were heartbreaking. And to me, it just essentialized, people were still hopeful at that point because they didn't realize that those jobs were never coming back.
And that was in a recession too. Where did those jobs go?
Well, initially, they left to the South, and you know, a lot of them now are overseas. I mean, the manufacturing heart fell out of the entire country. But because Milwaukee's reputation in the 1950s was the machine shop of the world. That's what it was known for. That's why people came here looking for jobs. I mean, we were a strong, strong manufacturing base. And now that manufacturing is, by and large, it was in the South. A lot of it's now Mexico, overseas, and it's not that there aren't jobs in the Milwaukee area now. That's what's partly so sad. But those jobs are in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. And the black community and poor people remain trapped in the city. There's no mass transit out to the suburbs. There's no low-income housing out in the suburbs. There's no attempt to really get people to those jobs or to bring jobs to the people who need them.
And that's intentional. That's a result of policy.
Well, intent's hard. It's even hard to prove in a murder case. And so I don't always look at intent, but, you know, you look at the effects of policies. I mean, you can say, well, we didn't intend for this to happen. Because that's what actually, in the desegregation case in Milwaukee, for years throughout the 60s and 70s, the school board said, well, we're not intentionally promoting segregated schools. But as the DSEG order in 1976 said, you mean to tell me that in the last 20 years you couldn't find even a single policy that could promote desegregation of the schools? And I say the same thing about jobs. You mean to tell me in the last 25 years you couldn't come up with a single policy that would promote employment in the inner city?
And so what happened to all these people who lost their jobs and their families?
Well, they're struggling very hard. They're still there in Milwaukee. I mean, Milwaukee has, you know, and sometimes we go back and forth, we're the worst or we're the second or the third, and we go back with Detroit or Buffalo. But generally, two things that are a hallmark in Milwaukee: we're the most hyper-segregated region in the country, and for black men of working age, we have the highest joblessness in the country. It's about 50%, and that's unheard of. And it's not like it's a 1 or 2 year phenomenon. This has been going on well over a decade.
I remember you wrote something for the Progressive on that, which was because that 55% figure was so shocking. Desegregation. Milwaukee also has the honor, if you can call it that, of being one of the most segregated cities in the country. I mean, this picture that you're painting, Barbara Minor, in Lessons from the Heartland, is of the dizzying decline of a great American city, and it's not unique to Milwaukee. It's just kind of magnified in Milwaukee. And how did Milwaukee deal with race at the beginning when the Great Migration started? I mean, there was a push, and, you know, my mom was involved in the fair housing movement in the suburbs of Chicago, so it was interesting for me to read about the efforts in Milwaukee to get fair housing ordinances through and the hostility there.
Well, Milwaukee, it's interesting because Milwaukee's civil rights movement, of course, as in the North in general, was after the desegregation and fighting Jim Crow in the South. So it was really in the early, mid-60s that its civil rights movement was at its strongest. And as you mentioned, the seminal civil rights struggle in Milwaukee was around open housing, led by Father Grappi, interestingly, a white priest leading the civil rights movement.
Tell us a little bit about Father Grappi, because he's a legend in Wisconsin.
A legend in his time.
Some people hate him still,
people
admire him still.
Well, one of the things that's fascinating about Father Grappi that people don't realize is like almost all the civil rights leaders of that time, from Father Grappi to King to Val Phillips, another leader in Milwaukee, they didn't differentiate as, oh, I'm into housing, oh, I'm into education, oh, I'm into jobs. They really saw housing, jobs, education as part of a whole. And that working together, these were the three main areas that helped reproduce or could reduce inequality. Interestingly, Father Grappi's first involvement in civil rights in Milwaukee was around schools and desegregation. In fact, the first time he got arrested, the first time a Catholic priest in Milwaukee got arrested during civil rights, was a protest against segregated schooling in Milwaukee. So it's fascinating. So anyhow, you went on to lead the open housing marches. And, you know, when we think about our current struggles here in Wisconsin, and it's easy to get discouraged, but, you know, I think back to the open housing marches, and it was just, it was tit for tat. I mean, at one point, the mayor at the time, Mayor Meyer, called Father Grappi Ku Klux Klanism in reverse. He didn't like one of his tactics. So what did Grappi do? The next day, he organizes hundreds of marchers to march on Mayor Meyer's home. It was like he was going to take the sitting down. And finally, the open housing marches, they marched every night for 200 nights in a row. And through the winter, I mean, people think it's cold right now here in Wisconsin. They were out marching every single night in similar weather to
and
get that
were,
open housing.
Barbara Meyer, sorry for interrupting. You were a teenager at the time. You tell a story of being in Catholic school and seeing the nuns wear ribbons or something. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, I was your classic Milwaukee suburban living in a fog kind of kid. I mean, I knew these things were going on. But in high school, I went to Catholic schools, traditional parents where, not that I was kept on a tight leash, but they were not about to let me go out at night to join civil rights protests. But interestingly, I went to Holy Angels, a Catholic girls' school. And I mean, it's just, when I think of some of the history, it just, even to this day, I'm astounded. But interestingly, that school was downtown. So there was a whole different flavor to who came to the school, what people were, you know, involved in. And it was also a time when the Catholic Church itself was very, very involved in social justice issues. In fact, a lot of the civil rights movement, the clergy was extremely involved. So in 1968, you know, I'm living in your you know, your sort of fog. And this was during the Vietnam War and the burning of draft files. And there were a number of Catholic clergy involved in that. And I go to school one morning, I see all these nuns wearing black armbands. I'm going, what's this all about? And it was in solidarity with the anti-Vietnam War protests.
Mm. And there's another member of your family who had an interesting Father Grappi story. She had been in his church and loved him, and then he was bringing a picket to her father's house.
My cousin Rosemary. Oh, it's again classic Milwaukee politics. His Father Grappi was originally from the South Side, which at that time was the stronghold of the racist forces who did not want open housing. So he had been at St. Veronica's, had a strong base at St. Veronica's. The kids loved him. The parishioners liked him. So when he's coming back in the 1960s, You know, he's at St. Boniface, a church in the central city, leading protests both against segregation, and Rosemary's uncle was on the school board, but also against the Eagles Club, which was a sort of whites-only, you know, anyone who was anyone in Milwaukee belonged to the Eagles Club, but it had this whites-only policy. So anyhow, they had a protest at, you know, again, Groppi, he wasn't afraid. He went to the heart of the South Side and had a protest at my uncle's house. And it's this great story about where Rosemary, she loved Father Groppi. He was her parish priest. You know, you go to Catholic school in the 1960s, you know, you were taught to idolize, you know, the parish priest. You never went against what they said. So she's at home. Her former priest, whom she loves and she knows, is out there protesting. Her neighbors are counter-picketing the protesters. Her father says, "Don't you dare go outside." And she's, all of a sudden, she says, "Wow, this world is not black and white. It's pretty complicated." And she never again completely took without questioning what her father told her.
Yeah, it was a real image for me. Him, her father, holding her back from her parish priest, who she wanted to embrace. I'm speaking with Barbara Miner. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at the Progressive Magazine. Barbara Miner is a journalist who's written for the Progressive. She has this really riveting and vitally important new book out called Lessons from the Heartland, A Turbulent Half-Century of Public Education in an Iconic American City. Reading it, I was thinking back about J. Anthony Lucas's work on Boston and busing and the problems that created. What was the busing situation like in Milwaukee?
Well, interestingly, because Boston came to symbolize the northern attempt to maintain segregated schools. And I never, until I researched this book, realized what an impact the violence in Boston had on Milwaukee, because it was really just a couple of months before. And so when the Milwaukee decision came down in 1976 to desegregate, one of the continuing undercurrents was, we're Milwaukee, we're not going to be another Boston. And so there was every attempt, in essence, to basically placate the whites so they would go along with desegregation. Well, that, unfortunately, the flip side of that was the burden was on the black community. So the very people who had been, you know, at the losing end of the segregated schools were then asked to carry the burden of desegregating the schools. And it was kind of classic Milwaukeean, quite frankly, where in very nice language and with a nice face, putting a seemingly positive spin on this, asked the black community to bear the burden of desegregation.
And by bearing the burden, you mean most of the kids who had to go on buses were black kids, or are there other
burdens?
The
only kids who were told they had to get on buses were black kids. And it was the black schools in the central city that were closed. And it was the black kids who were sent out to white schools in order to desegregate, rather than having what was called two-way busing, where whites would be going into the black schools. Now, they did have these sort of quote-unquote magnet schools, which were where whites and blacks would voluntarily sign up to go to the desegregated, into, you know, the schools. And there were so many positive aspects to those magnet schools. But by and large, it was what was called one-way busing, mandatory for blacks, voluntary for whites.
Now, there was an effort by some white liberals and progressives in Milwaukee to get more whites to sign up to integrate the predominantly black schools, too, and that was an interesting. Well,
Joel McNally, great journalist, one of the best journalists the city has ever had, and unfortunately fired by the Milwaukee Journal about 10 years ago. He was a little bit too outspoken, I guess. But that's the other thing, one of the lessons from the civil rights movement, is that there were so many good and honest and caring. The white community, it wasn't like, oh, the black community, you know, there weren't any whites in the white community who really felt the importance. I mean, diversity benefits us all. You know, that's one of the things we seem to forget. And there was an acute awareness. People wanted Milwaukee to work. They wanted desegregation to work. And there were good people in both the black and white community who wanted to move forward to together.
And one of the astonishing things that the white parents discovered when their kids went to one of the predominantly black schools was it had virtually no library, or the books in the library, the covers torn off and pages missing.
And you know what's sad, Matt, is when I look at some of what's going on in Milwaukee right now, I think the same thing might happen if you had some of the suburban parents come into the city schools. I mean, one of the really, really sad things is we had to fight this summer for a city ordinance that mandated playgrounds at elementary schools in the private voucher schools. Because the voucher movement, people were saying, well, you know, this might take money away from academic achievement. And we're saying, wait a minute, you're saying that kids should not have playgrounds at their schools? Are you serious? And they were. That's what's so frightening. And there's another, a rocket ship, which is one of these national franchise charters that the city is wooing. They're kind of like the McDonald's and Walmarts of education. And they're coming in, and they have a sort of a mass-produced cookie-cutter program. No art or music. And they're getting away with this. You would never go to the affluent suburbs. You could never go to Whitefish Bay, one of the affluent suburbs, and say, oh, yeah, we're going to bring in this national charter franchise, but they're not going to have art or music. People wouldn't put up for it.
I know in the big Chicago school strike of last year that some of the facilities, even the public schools, didn't have decent libraries and playgrounds, and that was a fight that the union brought to the public's attention. And that fight was won, largely. I'm speaking with Barbara Miner. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive. Barbara is the author of Lessons from the Heartland, A Turbulent Half-Century of Public Education in an Iconic American City. Well, you brought us up to the present with vouchers and charters introducing that. Wisconsin, under Tommy Thompson, was known as a pioneer in this field. What is that all about, and how has it turned out?
Well, I make no bones about it. I think vouchers are an unabashed abandonment of public education. I mean, it's clear. If you really look into the issue, there's no doubt. It's a funneling of money, public tax dollars, out of public education into private schools that don't follow the same rules as public schools. I mean, you can have a voucher school that's 100%, every single kid in that school gets a taxpayer-funded voucher, yet they get to call themselves quote-unquote private. So as a result, they don't have to hire certified teachers. They can teach creationism if they want. They don't have to follow constitutional rights of due process or free speech. They don't even have to follow open meetings and records. And so what we're doing, and I believe in what you didn't want to, you know, you mentioned intent, but I believe that this is the intent of some of the people in the voucher movement, is to abandon public education and set up a system where that public money is funneled into private schools. And it's a marketplace approach where, like everything, what's the big thing you bring to the marketplace? You bring money. So people who have money will do better under a marketplace voucherized system, and people who don't won't.
So why are they trying to destroy the public? Is it because they're going to profit from it?
Well, I think there's a lot of different reasons, and it's an interesting sort of it's sort of like a perfect storm of different forces. The Bradley Foundation, which is based in Milwaukee and which used Wisconsin in the 1990s as a guinea pig for both welfare and voucher and private schools, it's one of the most powerful conservative foundations in the country, and in fact has parceled out more money over the years than the Koch brothers. It's just not as well known nationally. They keep a little bit lower radar. Well, I remember, this was probably about 15, 20 years ago, and I was interviewing Michael Joyce, then head of the Bradley Foundation, and he says to me very clearly, point blank, he believes that public schools were a form of socialism. And of course, the Bradley Foundation, they don't believe in socialism. So, you know, there are people who fundamentally don't believe in public education, don't understand its relationship to a vibrant democracy, don't understand the role of public education in defending and supporting democracy. And, you know, you go back to Milton Friedman, who is the ideological godfather of vouchers. And he was very clear. You know, he saw education kind of like food stamps. Everyone would get a voucher. Some people would take that voucher and add some money and go to a nice private school. Some people would take that voucher and buy what they could. I suppose sort of the equivalent of do you get to buy steak or do you get to buy a McDonald's hamburger?
Barbara Miner, you've got a little passage in this book, Lessons from the Heartland, right on this subject of vouchers and how they service not the greater interests of citizens in education, but something else. So I'd love it if you could read that.
Well, yeah, the reason I want to read this is because from its very beginning, vouchers were a bait-and-switch program. You know, at the beginning, it was like a bait-and-switch of, oh, all we care about is poor black kids. They don't even talk about that anymore. Now they talk about, oh, we want choice so people can, you know, people can leave failing schools. Well, you know, my kids went to a quote-unquote failing school, and, well, my oldest daughter's now in Yale Law School, so I don't think she did too bad at that failing school, and in fact, she did great, and the schools did great for her. But anyway, I want to read this because it shows that you just can't believe the rhetoric that's out there about vouchers. So this is from Chapter 21, which is titled Vouchers for Religious Schools Advance, Abandonment Advances. And I'll read from this now. Dave Barrett was editorial page editor of the Milwaukee Journal during the 1990s. As is customary in the media, certain people's phone calls bypass the secretary and go straight to influential editors. In 1990, when the voucher controversy was first surfacing in Milwaukee, Barrett got a call from a, quote, prominent Milwaukee business executive. He wanted to speak off the record. And this is how Dave tells the story. He said some well-connected powers that be had concluded that it was finally time to pump taxpayer dollars into the Catholic schools, because that was the only way to save them. The push would be framed as an effort to help impoverished black children get a better education, which was Polly Williams' agenda, but that saving the Catholic schools was the driving force. Apparently it was expected, correctly, that the Supreme Court of this state would never strike vouchers down as unconstitutional. To coin a phrase, the rest is history.
And it's not as though the Catholic schools didn't have any money. I mean, you know, the Catholic schools have ability to get money of their own outside of the public coffers.
Well, and you know, religious. I went to Catholic schools, so I understand religious education, and I understand the importance of the separation of church and state. But what's happening is that public taxpayers are being asked to support religious education that they may not believe in, and that, to me, is a violation of the public's right to freedom of religion. I mean, right now, 85% of the people, of the students receiving vouchers in Milwaukee, they go to religious schools. Oh. And there are now 25,000 students receiving vouchers. I mean, if you looked at the voucher program as an, you know, in size as an independent school district, it would be just behind Milwaukee and Madison in its size.
And now the governor wants to reproduce vouchers in other places.
And he's going to use another bait and switch and come with all sorts of sweet-sounding rhetoric. But this is what I will tell, you know, your listeners across the state of Wisconsin. If you care even a little bit about your public schools surviving, and if you care even a little bit about public control over public institutions, you should organize your brains out against these vouchers.
Yeah, because they're coming, and they're coming not just in Wisconsin, but around the country. And for a real in-depth look at the crisis of public education and deindustrialization, I urge you, the listener, to pick up this book by Barbara Miner, Lessons from the Heartland. Barbara Miner, thanks so much for being my guest
today.
Thank
you, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.